WAER Sports proudly presents the Ostrom Avenue Podcast.
At the 30, at the 20, cuts towards the middle, and Nykeem Johnson takes it home for a Syracuse touchdown.
The Orange going quick. Bounce pass, Jimmy Boeheim, baseline drive, and jam!
Going through all the good.
To the midline, it's bobbled, and Syracuse wins!
A winding shot by Trimboli, 10 yards out, shoots, he scores!
And all the bad.
Syracuse, bowl ineligible for the third straight year.
They made it into the NCAA tournament as a number 11 seed, but it is over as Houston moves on to the Elite Eight.
And now, here are your hosts, Johnny Gadamowitz and Ethan Frank.
All right, all right, all right. Welcome into another edition of the Ostrom Avenue Podcast. And Syracuse has a national championship under its belt. The men's soccer team takes down Indiana in neutral site carry on Monday night in what was a thriller of a game to capture their first ever national championship in penalty kicks, no less. What a way to kick off another episode of the Ostrom Avenue Pod. Johnny Gadamowitz, Ethan Frank, Jordan Leonard. Guys, what's going on? Where were you Monday? I mean, I know where you guys were. You guys were inside the friendly confines of the JMA Wireless Dome. How was it? What was the experience like being on campus? I'm back home for break. You guys still in the Salt City. Put me there. What was it like?
Well, I didn't know we had Matthew McConaughey hosting this podcast with that intro, Johnny. But it was very, very cool. Jordan had a better seat than I did in terms of watching the basketball game. But I'd argue I had the better seat to watch the soccer match, because where Jordan was sitting is right, you know, near courtside by the TV booth. So that means he had to look all the way up to the top of the stadium of the dome where the big Jumbotron is. I, in my press row seat, could look at the giant hanging Jumbotron in the middle of the dome, which was much closer and much easier to view. So it was very, very cool. The entire student section did not watch the first half of the basketball game. They went behind the grandstand. So if you're looking at the court from, let's say, where the student section is, the entire student section went behind the grandstand to watch the soccer match. And I was trying to, as I was covering the basketball game, I was also trying to watch the soccer match on my phone, because, I mean, when are you going to get another national championship? It is something that does not come around very often. So I was trying to follow it, and the broadcast the students were watching over in the East End Zone was about 30 seconds ahead of me. So anytime there was an ooh or an ah, and I was like, oh no, what happened? So good or bad. But it went to penalties, and it timed up perfectly that penalties started and ended during halftime. Talked in the locker room after the game with Jesse Edwards and Judah Mintz. They said Coach Boeheim was not thrilled that the players were kind of peeking over at the Jumbotron to watch the end of the soccer match instead of the warming up for the second half. But Jesse Edwards said he went to almost every single soccer home game this season for this team. And then he was there at 2 a.m. like I was to greet the team. And I mean, shout out to Ian McIntyre. This guy, I mean, I was texting this morning with some people, and like that I was there. And I mean, the words that come to my Ian McIntyre, humble, thoughtful, just so appreciative. He gave a high five to every single person that was waiting there outside of Manly Fieldhouse.
In 10-degree weather, no less.
Yes, in 10-degree weather at 2:30 a.m., waited until everyone had left to get in his car, scrape off all the snow and ice that had accumulated over the last few days, and then drive off into the night a national champion. I mean, that guy is all class. You could see it through the TV, through his interviews, just the way he speaks. He's an incredible coach and just an incredible person. So I could not be happier for him. It was a really cool evening and over a span of a few hours.
Yeah, it was awesome. I was also trying to watch it on my phone as trying to report on the basketball game. And I've lost my voice a little bit trying to like rooting for the men's soccer team. I was sitting next to who was on stats for the basketball game, Annie Claff. And she was like, when it got to 6-6, she's like, she couldn't watch, because it was like, and it was the longest they'd ever gotten in penalties, I think, in college soccer history. But you talk about how you were looking over behind the grandstands, Ethan. Indiana scored their game tying goal at 2 during the national anthem. So it's like the students had to hold in the groans during the national anthem when they're watching on the other side. It was awesome.
Nathan Opoku and Kurt Kalov, the two regulation goal scorers for the Cuse. It was the Orange and the Hoosiers really just trading blows throughout the entirety of that game. And then, of course, Anfernee Sinclair, one of the more veteran tenured players on the team, providing the game-winning penalty kick. And a shout-out to Russell Shealy as well. I mean, the Orange goalkeeper, I couldn't imagine having to go through a situation like that, standing in net between the pipes, making save after save with the national championship on the line. That's not a situation I'd want to be in. But Shealy was certainly up to the task, and of course an integral part to capturing that national championship for Syracuse. So a lot to celebrate, a lot to be proud about for a team that has just been a heck of a lot of fun to watch down this home stretch.
Yeah, and before we move on, Johnny, I know you definitely covered some of these games this season for the men's soccer team. Did you see this coming, watching this team in the regular season?
It's funny you say that, because I was in the ACC Network broadcast booth for a very early regular season game. It was actually the opener. It was when Syracuse played Iona at SU Soccer Stadium on Thursday, August 25th. And if you told me then that that team was going to be in a national championship game, no shot. And Ian McIntyre said a similar thing after the game had concluded yesterday. They had him on the broadcast for, you know, a post-game interview where he was, you know, wonderful as always. And the final question they asked him was, look, did you kind of see this coming? And he said no. And I don't think that, you know, I think that makes sense. I would agree with that sentiment. It was a 2-0 win at the time over Iona. But, you know, if we're talking national championship caliber team, they probably should have beat Iona 7-0 at that point. So, no, to answer your question. And, you know, I think it was one of those instances where this team just got better as the season went along. And then they were playing their best soccer at the end of the year when it mattered most.
It feels like they were just a team. Sorry to cut you off, Jordan. It just feels like they were a team of destiny in a way. Like every win, it just felt like, okay, the ball is continuing to roll. And it's not like they're blowing teams out. I want to say almost every single game in the NCAA tournament was either a 1 or 2 goal win.
It was only one. Lucky goal win. Penn was 2-1 in OT, then 1-0 over Cornell, 2-1 over Vermont, 3-2 over Creighton, and then, of course, the national championship.
So, like, they were getting it done in so many different ways. Sometimes it was, you know, these defensive slugfests where even getting the ball even close to the net and maybe finding the back of it was a struggle, or it was, you know, that 3-2 game against Creighton in the Final Four, like you mentioned, Johnny. But it just felt like every game that they kept winning, that hope and anticipation was building. I guess the fun thing about a run like this is that your expectations were not very high. And when you have an unexpected run, those are usually the most fun, because it's more joy at the end than it is relief. Like when you go into something expecting something, you're more likely to be disappointed than you are, you know, elated. At this point with this team, it was, wow, soccer, Syracuse. I mean, those two things don't really go that well together.
In December, no less.
Yeah, when the team's returning home and it's 15 degrees outside and there's snow on the ground, not really a place for soccer. But honestly, every game, to me, they just felt like a team of destiny. And thankfully for Syracuse fans, thankfully for the players, coaches, staff, it worked out in the end. And I couldn't be happier for a better group.
Yeah, Johnny, I got to ask how you asked about our experience. What were you watching it? Were you doing the split screen?
I was doing the split screen. It's funny because I was hanging out with my family in the basement. They were watching a TV show and I had the split screen going on my laptop. And then sure enough, the episode ended, whatever it was, right as it was about to go to PKs. I said, guys, this doesn't happen very often. National championship penalty kicks. We got to put this on the big screen. They agreed and they were on board and they got into it too. So give them credit there. But yes, we watched the PKs on the big TV downstairs and then made the transition over to hoops for the second half. But it was an interesting night. You know, I would be lying if I said I didn't regret I'm not in Syracuse. I wish it was an atmosphere that I could have enjoyed. I'm sure campus must have been quite the scene last night, especially at 2 a.m. when the bus got back. But massive, massive congratulations are in order for Ian McIntyre and the rest of this men's soccer team, a national championship, and certainly a whole lot to be proud about. We'll transition over to hoops because there's some stuff to be proud about as well for this SU men's basketball team. Four straight wins after they got the doors blown off of them by Illinois a few weeks ago. Obviously, the ACC opener at Notre Dame, then you steamroll Oakland, handle Georgetown pretty easily. And it took a little longer than I think any of us would have thought, but you still get to a double-digit win over Monmouth. And now on the year 7-4 with a couple of more tune-up non-conference games, if you will, coming up. I say stuff to be proud of in terms of the wins, guys, but I got to be honest. I mean, I'm a little worried. You can't let Monmouth shoot 57% in the first half. You can't let Monmouth shoot nearly 50% in the game. I know a win's a win. But I think that was my takeaway from yesterday was that, look, this is 1-9 Monmouth. This has no business being a game. That game should have been over before it even started. And I think the weird thing about it is it's not like I can even pin it on anything. Like, yeah, okay, the defense was terrible, especially in the first half. And Boeheim said that after the game. But outside of, like, the defense being better, which, granted, of course, is a very big thing, there's not a lot of things that I can point to that say, oh yeah, that really went wrong. That's something you need to fix. That's something you need to address. And even still, it's only a 15-point win over 1-9 Monmouth. I don't know if you guys agree. That was sort of my overarching takeaway from yesterday, even with four wins in a row.
I mean, it was effort was the thing. Boeheim came into the press conference and just absolutely tore his forwards a new one, said our forwards didn't want to play basketball tonight. That's Chris Bell was not good. Benny was bad in the first half, but turned it on a little bit in the second half, started getting some rebounds, had an and-one layup, had an and-one three. So he turned it on a little bit. John Bull was not good. I mean, this is what you're getting with John Bull. I understand that, you know, he has like some sort of intangibles. He's got this decent passing ability, but I mean, he can't move, guys. Like, he can't move. His athleticism is about a 2 out of 10. I understand he knows exactly where he needs to be on defense, and that's a good thing. But he just can't get there fast enough when teams are swinging the ball around and making quick passes. And thankfully for Syracuse, Monmouth was in the 330s on KenPom's offensive efficiency coming into this game. Syracuse's defense dropped by 20 spots on KenPom last night. So that was really embarrassing. And the other forward was Malik Brown. He was probably the best of the four forwards who played last night, finally getting some extended run. And Boeheim was talking about after the game, he's not quite there yet, which I understand because his positioning is still a little bit off. And on offense, he doesn't really know where to be. He's kind of just clogging the lane because he has no shooting threat. So like the thing that Boeheim was talking about was we needed Malik in the game to help Jesse rebound, but they were also playing Benny at the three because Bell was just not good. So, and Taylor didn't get any minutes, which was weird. He just didn't have it. But when you play Benny, Malik, and Jesse, that's three almost non-shooters. It clogs up the paint so much that Jesse can't post up. And there were a couple times where there was some good big-to-big passing, some offensive rebounds. Jesse had a nice assist to Malik, I remember, underneath the basket. But that's a very tough offensive unit and not one you're going to play with in conference play, I would imagine, unless Benny dramatically becomes a knockdown three-point shooter that can stand on the perimeter. So he was very upset with his forwards and said he doesn't really know, indicated maybe he might change the starting lineup when asked about it after the game. I believe that was you who asked that, Jordan.
It was me. I asked him the question. I was like, you thinking about changing the starting lineup? And he said, I think about a lot of things. And like right now I'm thinking about getting some food. So he who knows? I think something has to change in the starting lineup because if he's going to take Chris Bell out after 3 minutes every time, if he's so annoyed about the fact that Chris Bell got zero rebounds, why is he in the starting lineup is my question. I think Malik Brown should be getting more minutes. I know he's not really an offensive threat at the moment. He's one of those guys that gets the offensive rebounds and goes back up with it. And that's where he gets his 11 points. And he goes 1 of 3 from free throws. But I think just he shows the energy. I think he brought energy when he came to the floor. And Syracuse has not come out with any when they've started the game the last three games going back to Oakland and Georgetown. So I think something needs to happen in the starting lineup. There needs to be a switch to just give this team a shot in the arm, especially to start. Because if you start slow, then you have to work your way back to get it tied, and then you have to get over the hump to get a lead.
Right, and those things don't just happen in conference play. You don't come back from deficits like that against real ACC teams, and this January schedule is a gauntlet. But two things to follow up on what you said. I want to go around the horn and see who you guys would insert into the starting lineup over Chris Bell. But before we do that, I have to say, I was at the two games in Brooklyn, and Boeheim continued to talk about Chris Bell's rebounding. And from where we were sitting, Johnny, you were there. It was kind of like we were pretty high up. We weren't that close to the court. Being where I was sitting yesterday, I thought the Chris Bell rebounding thing was a little bit of a bit. It was like kind of just Boeheim going at a young player. The stats didn't show it, but he was trying. Watching yesterday, okay, it was jarring. There were multiple times Chris Bell had inside positioning for a rebound and almost didn't jump or got out jumped or got pushed out of the way because he's 6'7", 200 pounds.
So does that fall under your, because I know something you hit on before, Ethan, was the effort aspect of things. Is it a matter of just not crashing the boards, or is it a more physical lack of capability?
I think it's both. I think it's both. Something I would do that I suggested on the double overtime the other day after the Georgetown game, I would think about playing Chris Bell at the top of the zone, because if he is not able to rebound, he's essentially a two guard. So why on offense? Obviously, he's 6'7", 6'8", so he's a wing player. Why not play him at the top of the zone? Michael Benajee was 6'7" and made the transformation from forward to point guard. I'm not saying Chris Bell is going to be your point guard, but there have been very tall players that have succeeded at the top of the 2-3 zone. So yes, you don't want to take Joe or Judah off the floor, but maybe in an experimental way, if you have the chance, why not try Chris Bell at the top of the zone and use his length to his advantage, because he's not helping you rebounding wise.
I don't hate it. I don't. I mean, I think, look, if that's something they're going to experiment with, it's going to have to happen over these next few games before you get into the conference play. But for me, I don't know. I think Chris Bell perfectly fits the mold of what a good sixth man can be, right? Like that energy guy, spark off the bench, doesn't need to eat up a ton of minutes, can knock down shots, maybe doesn't offer a whole lot outside of knocking down those shots. But like, everyone wants to push this Bell starting lineup, you know, short leash narrative. And obviously that's what's happened so far. But I think in order for his potential to be maximized, he should not be a starter. I think a lot of Orange fans have learned that at this point in the year. I think Jim Boeheim has learned that this in the year. So you mentioned, you know, you're curious, Ethan, to see who the alternative is there. I see no reason why a guy like Justin Taylor can't occupy that spot. I mean, I think.
Yeah, that's who I was going to say.
He's shown enough at this point in the year where I'm comfortable rolling him out there, giving him starting type minutes against ACC competition. Is there room for improvement? Sure. He's a freshman. When is there not room for improvement with freshmen? But at the end of the day, I think a situation where you have, and again, all this comes with a grain of salt, because it was someone who said it, that, you know, doesn't really matter who's starting games, it matters who's finishing games. And that's what, you know, you should really take more stock into as far as the five on the court when Syracuse needs to close out a close game down the stretch. But I don't know. I think it makes too much sense not to have Bell kind of be that spark plug that comes off the bench that, as I mentioned earlier, gives you that burst of energy, can be a threat from range for a team that doesn't really have a lot of threats from range. I wonder how much longer we're going to see the starting five up on the board or up on the live stats, what have you, and Chris Bell's name being in there.
Two things off of that is, one, I think it has to be Taylor, because if you start, the other options would be John Bull or Malik Brown. So neither of those players offer shooting, and I don't think Benny will be taken out of the starting lineup, considering he's, you know, a sophomore. He has the experience. but you need shooting on the floor. You cannot have two non-shooting forwards start a game. And to go back to your point of what Brent said, it's not about who starts, it's about who finishes. When you're starting every game down double digits, it kind of does matter who's starting, because there are times you're not going to be able to climb out of these holes. So yes, obviously who's finishing is more important than who's starting. But if your starters are putting you in a 10-point hole every game, then a change probably does need to be made. What were you going to say, Jordan?
No, I agree that they need to start better. You can't fight back every single game. I think Malik Brown, I'm not a huge John Ball guy. I think he's the definition of what a stiff is. Like he's limited in his athleticism. I'm a Malik Brown fan only because with the offense that's on the floor being Judah, Jesse, and Joe, I think, and Benny, when Benny like played good on offense yesterday, 5-10 from the field, I think that's enough offense to start the game where you can put a defensive minded guy. Cause it's not necessarily the offense has had a slow start over the last couple of games. The defense has just been really bad to start the game. Like their rotations have been bad. They've either been slow or they're going past the shooters and they're allowing penetration into the middle of the zone. So I think there's enough offense to start the game on the floor that you can sub in a defensive minded player to start.
I think that makes a lot of sense. You know, we'll see, right? That's why they play the games. I think we're at the point now where, look, you've got Cornell coming up this Saturday. You've got the first three ACC games, there's no reason you can't go out there and go 3-for-3, talking about Pitt at home next Tuesday, Boston College on New Year's Eve in the Dome, and then you hit the road for Louisville after the New Year. But that sort of segues me into where I want to go next with this, guys. Where are we at right now as far as the expectation going forward? Is this a team that you know, come late February, early March, is going to be pushing 20 regular season wins? What's the temperature in the room as far as what we've learned about this non-conference slate so far, and how much have our expectations changed? We spent all football season talking about changing expectations. What's the status quo for you guys as far as what the ceiling and what the floor is of this team going forward?
I mean, it's hard to say. I don't feel great right now after this game against Monmouth. You look at the next four. I'm using my two analytics sites, my favorite that I bring up all the time, KenPom, as well as Bart Torvik's T-Rank.
You got to start calling Ethan KenPom Frank.
You can. I mean, he's got a projected 15-16 record, 9-11 in conference. So that, you know, that's the, he says Syracuse is going to beat Pittsburgh, BC, Louisville, as we said, Notre Dame at home, BC at home, Georgia Tech at home, Wake Forest at home. He doesn't have them winning a single road game except for at Boston College and at Louisville, who's obviously terrible. Even at Florida State, who's awful. He has them projected to lose only by 1 point, but I mean, there are winnable games there for Syracuse in conference. There are coin flip games that they'll have to win if they want any chance of making the NCAA tournament. I see them anywhere from 9-12 ACC wins. I don't think it's any more than that right now. I mean, you look at the tough teams. They have to play Virginia and Virginia Tech twice. You got to play at Miami, who's very good. You got to play North Carolina and Duke. Clemson on the road is a pretty good team. I mean, this schedule is not easy. So I'm worried about the month of January. That's going to be a very, very tough month when you have a stretch of Virginia Tech, Notre Dame, Miami, Georgia Tech, North Carolina, Virginia Tech, Virginia again. So you start that stretch with the two Virginia schools and you end it with the same two schools. And those are two of the top four teams in the conference right now. So I'm pretty worried about that when it comes to that, because you can't start slow against those teams. You can't have, you know, Benny on the back of the zone losing two guys behind him on the first three possessions of the game against Monmouth. So do I think this team will develop? Yes. The problem, as Boeheim mentioned last night, was that they're relying on their guards for everything right now. And the last few games, Joe has shot the ball well, but we saw what happened when Joe did not shoot the ball well. And when you're relying on Joe to score, that is a problem, because you need other players to supplement him in the scoring department. Judah was terrific last night. He was my highest graded player of the game. I thought he was excellent. I mean, his free throw shooting the last two games has been terrific, because I asked him after the game. He said, you know, the first few games, I was around 60% at the foul line, and I've always been a good free throw shooter, and that was really upsetting me. And I asked him, are you feeling more comfortable at the line? He said, well, I'm just getting back to me. I'm getting back to what I've been doing my whole life. So I think that was really encouraging as well. His passing has been terrific as well through the last few games. Double-double with assists against Georgetown, another five last night. And his defense at the top of the zone has been good. He's really good at reading passes and picking them off, getting a foot or a hand in the passing lane. So I understand relying on your guards to score. That's what guards are for. But when you're relying on Joe Girard to score and you don't have any supplementary scoring from, you know, you don't have reliable scoring, let's say, from the forward position, then when Joe's off, you are desperate for more scoring and you just don't have that consistency is what worries me on offense.
Yeah, Drew even hit a three for the first time since Colgate last night, which was awesome. What worried me last night was how Jesse Edwards responded to, as Jim Boeheim quoted, physicality, which I find it hard to believe Monmouth was like quite physical enough to hold Jesse Edwards, considering they only had Amon Sandu, who was a 7-footer, in there for like 10 minutes. And then other than that, they had no guy above 6'9". But I think Jesse Edwards is going to have to play. Like, he's going to have to score and rebound in every single game for Syracuse to have a chance to win, because if the guards are the ones scoring the ball, the defense is going to adjust and you need somebody to go down low. And if it's not going to be the forwards, it's going to have to be Jesse Edwards. I think the stretch that you talked about, Ethan, in January, kind of like the stretch last year in February where they went to North Carolina, they went to Notre Dame, they played Duke at the end of the year, I think that's going to be kind of their murderer's row of sorts this year. And that stretch is really going to tell you how many wins they're going to get. If they can split it, if they can get like 2 of 6 or something like that, that'll tell you kind of how the ACC schedule will wrap up. I think right now Syracuse is just so unpredictable. Their defense like can either be really good or it can be really bad against Illinois. Their offense can be really good if Joe Girard scores, or it can be really bad if Joe Girard doesn't score. So I think they'll continue to develop, like you said, Ethan. I think the freshmen need to get it going. Like, Chris Bell needs to figure out how to please Jim Boeheim so he can stay on the floor. Because when he's on the floor, he's been making shots. And I think if they give more minutes to Malik Brown, I think that's also a key, because John Bolajak's been the energy bunny of sorts kind of earlier this year. I think Malik Brown can be that same thing, where he brings the energy and he's just like, he's playing his heart out. And I think he can energize the team to do that. And especially in bigger games, like when you know the other team is more talented than you, the one way you can win is rebounding energy and out hustling them. And that's what I think Syracuse kind of has to do, especially in a zone when you struggle to rebound. You have to bring the energy to kind of compensate for that.
Well, the next opportunity for the Orange to do just that comes this Saturday when SU welcomes Cornell at 3 p.m. in the first Syracuse-Cornell basketball game that will not have a Boeheim on the court in quite some time. The Cuse and Cornell get going at 3 p.m. Of course, WAER's got you covered at 2:30 with McClurg team countdown and tip-off. Guys, before we close up shop, a little bit of noteworthy news on the gridiron, seeing some rumors and names tossed around recently as far as the coaching carousel is concerned. And Syracuse has really learned that the hard way over this past week with the loss of both Robert and I and Tony White. Had people thinking, okay, could Dino Babers potentially be on the way out? And a school that was coming up time and time again in those conversations was none other than Purdue University. And Purdue, as of Tuesday morning, naming former Illini defensive coordinator Ryan Walters their next head football coach. So I don't think Dino's going anywhere. I know we all kind of have our different theories and preferences as far as that is concerned. But Purdue is a school that you can officially cross off the list if Mr. Babers is indeed looking elsewhere.
Yeah, I think the prevailing theory of what we got from Dino Babers being considered a candidate or a name to watch at Purdue is, you know, maybe a little agent manipulation, trying to be like, hey, John Wildhack, Dino's getting looks from other schools. You might want to put some more money in this man's pocket. Is how I've read into it since there was just all smoke and no fire. But yeah, I don't really expect Tino to go anywhere. I just don't want John Wildhack to make another crazy decision where he gives him a very lucrative extension after one good season, and then the following three seasons are just tearing it back down to the ground. So that's really all I have to say on Dino. He's probably not going anywhere, just looking for some more money out of Syracuse's pockets. But I will talk about the coordinators, because that, you know, I sent out a couple tweets from our account last week. I mean, Tony White, people are saying, you know, some people are saying it's a lateral move. Some people are saying it's a step up. I think it's a step up. I mean, Nebraska is one of the most historic programs in the history of college football. I understand they've been down for a while. Last I checked, they still sell out every game in Lincoln, Nebraska. So, I mean, that is a pretty big feat in itself. I'm sure he's getting a nice raise. And Matt Rhule is a proven college football coach. For all the failures he had with the Panthers, I mean, this guy built up Baylor. I mean, Baylor, talk about rock bottom. I mean, that was an absolute I don't even know the word for it. Probably not okay to say. I mean, what that program was before Matt Rhule got there, because of everything that went on. So I think this is a step up for Tony White, and it's just one more step in the ladder before he eventually becomes a head coach. Robert Anai, now that is interesting. I am a little conspicuous as to why maybe Robert Anai just wanted to come to Syracuse to set up Jason Beck, is my deep conspiracy theory, is that this was always going to be a two-year operation for Anai, because, I mean, Beck's been working under him for almost 15 years now. He definitely deserved to be an offensive coordinator somewhere after being a quarterback's coach for so long and the track record he had working with quarterbacks. So maybe, you know, it happened quicker than they thought, but Anai is not a young guy, and Beck is not an old guy. So Beck needed this opportunity, and I think Syracuse was right to give it to him, because I trust his vision, and I think he'll bring new things to the offense next season. So I like promoting Jason Beck to the full-time offensive coordinator. Nick Monroe's the interim defensive coordinator. He's been Syracuse's best recruiting coach over the past few cycles, bringing in guys like Deuce Chestnut, I mean, Elijah Clark in the transfer portal, and really building up the secondary. He's the passing game coordinator on defense, and Syracuse's passing defense has been very good. So that tells you all you need to know there. But, I mean, a lot of turnover, and we'll see how things all shake out in January. But a lot more news going on with the football program than I think we expected over the last week or so.
Yeah, losing two coordinators in one day was definitely not expected. I think Tony White definitely got a step up in Nebraska. Coaching a Big Ten defense is definitely different than coaching an ACC defense. And then I think, I don't know about the conspiracy theory. I think Robert and I going to NC State, obviously they're a better team than Syracuse. They were ranked pretty much all year when they had Devin Leary. So I think it's a step up for him. I do like very much the hire of, or the promotion of Jason Beck. I think he's going to be a good offensive coordinator. But I was more looking up, how about the defensive lineman transfer from Alabama? I mean, the defensive line was decimated due to injury, and then it was painful to watch. How about getting a four-star from Alabama as a defensive line transfer in the portal? That was awesome.
Certainly big news and some good news from a Syracuse football standpoint. Of course, we'll have plenty of
Hold your horses. If someone's been at Alabama for 4 years and they're finally entering the transfer portal, there's got to be something up. If you're leaving Alabama for Syracuse, that smells a little fishy to me.
He got an offer from Alabama. He's playing on Alabama.
Okay, that was also 4 years ago.
You take what you can get.
Exactly.
Obviously, I'll take what I can get with this defensive line. But yes, something still smells a little off to me.
Regardless, Syracuse gets ready for Minnesota in the Pinstripe Bowl. We'll have plenty of coverage on that Pinstripe Bowl in next week's pod, leading up, of course, to the big game at Yankee Stadium on December 29th. That'll just about wrap things up for this edition of the Ostrom Avenue podcast. Syracuse men's soccer, national champions. Syracuse men's basketball, 4 wins in a row. Syracuse football, gearing up for a bowl game. And oh yeah, Kodai Senga is a New York Met as well. Gotta love that. With Ethan and Jordan, I'm Johnny saying so long. You can find us wherever you get your podcast. That'll do it for this edition of the Ostrom Avenue Pod. Thanks so much for joining us as always, and we'll talk next week.